Thanks. Appreciate it. I have a different microphone. Is this working okay? Is it up too high? No. At any point you cannot hear me, raise your hand, because I could inadvertently... So that'll help me. Okay, we'll get started. I'm going to speak here for about an hour. We'll stand and stretch and have a dialogue for about 20 minutes. And then we'll take a half hour break. And then there'll be a second conference with question and answer period. And both of these morning sessions will be on Thomas Merton. So we'll be devoting ourselves to Thomas Merton this morning. And then in the evening, in the afternoon, we'll turn to Teresa. And we'll be looking for resonances between these two mystics. We'll see how there's this ongoing mystical lineage of mystical consciousness in the Christian tradition, open to the mystical lineage of all the world's great religions. And I hear I want to approach Thomas Merton and Teresa as mystic teachers. That is, they bear witness to the reality of mystical consciousness in the world. And they also offer trustworthy guidance for those who are being interiorly drawn toward more unitive, mystical ways of experiencing God's oneness with us in life itself, like contemplative spiritual direction. And so I'll be focusing on both of them in that way. And also I want to hear, get at the intimacy of it. That is, not to turn to Thomas Merton as a topic, it's just a fascinating, complex figure in contemporary Catholicism in terms of social justice and poetry in the church and so on, that's valid and helpful. But I want to approach him as the person someone turns to who says things that resonate with your heart, like he's speaking of something that I desire to live in fidelity to experience and to approach it at that level. Okay, so we get started. Good. First, a brief biographical sketch of Thomas Merton, if you're not aware of him this way. Most people are, I think. Thomas Merton was born in 1915 in France. His father was an artist. He had one brother. His parents were, there was no religious context to the family life at home. If anything, it was kind of suspicious of institutional religion. Both parents died of cancer when he was young. He went to Cambridge University for 1 year and Wine, Women, and Song, except he didn't sing. And kind of on the wild side, so he got a woman pregnant. She died apparently in one of the raids there during the war. Concerned about him, they sent him to New York, where they thought there were relatives there that could keep a closer eye on him. And he attended Columbia University, majoring in English literature. And while at Columbia, had a series of religious experiences, which then led him to be baptized in the Catholic tradition. And when he was baptized, he, wondering what God will was for him, and he considered for a while working with Dorothy Day, the Catholic worker movement in Harlem. He considered for a time joining the Franciscans. He considered, and Dorothy Day decided he wasn't to do that. The Franciscans thought that he didn't have a vocation to the Franciscans, which they probably kicked themselves for losing that one. I don't know. Like, whose idea was that? And he was going to join the army. He was a conscientious objector. He had bad teeth. He didn't get in the army. And he was attending philosophy classes by Dan Walsh, And Dan Walsh was the first Catholic to teach at Columbia in the philosophy department, medieval philosophy. And Dan Walsh told Thomas Merton about monasteries, about Gethsemane the Trappist. He said, they accept anybody there. Just go down. And he went down and was deeply moved by it. And under 28 years old, gave up a promising career in literature and became a cloistered monk. He wrote his autobiography, The Seven-Story Mountain, from Dante, the Divine Comedy, Heaven is a Seven-Story Mountain. It went on the New York Times bestsellers list, and overnight Merton became famous. Because during the war, there was so much darkness in the world from the war, and had this brilliant young person seek God, inspired people. And that book then was followed by many others, and Thomas Merton went on to become one of the most widely read, widely known spiritual writers in our time, really. In the 1960s, in his ongoing evolving life, he became very taken on the importance of social justice. And there's a story, the famous story of the second conversion experience of Thomas Merton. He had to go into Louisville for medical treatments frequently. And standing at a crowded intersection in downtown Louisville, waiting for a red light, suddenly realized he loved all those people. And realized that the authentic contemplative life is a life that grounds us in the preciousness of the world. God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten son. And he wrote a book called Seeds of Destruction and became one of the Christian thinkers that was energizing the pro-Dr. Martin Luther King movement, the anti-Vietnam movement, the anti-nuclear war movement. The Berrigan brothers came there and would speak with him and so on. And the second thing he became very interested in, committed to, was serious dialogue with the non-Christian contemplative traditions. He wrote a letter to the Zen scholar, D.T. Suzuki, and said, when I read these Zen stories about enlightenment, something leaps off the page at me and says, this is true. And I'd like to know if I, as a Christian, can dialogue with you as a Buddhist about our common ground. Thomas Merton said, the world will not survive religion based on tribal consciousness. But if religious people who are drawing close to what's the truest in their own tradition, which transcends their own tradition, which is the infinite, intimately realized, and they would speak up, religious people could be at the heart of world unity and world harmony and world tolerance. And so Thich Nhat Hanh came there from Vietnam and spent time with him. Abraham Heschel came and talked with him. Bede Griffith came from India, from the ashram in India, and Sufis came to speak with him, the Muslim mystical tradition. And so he saw the Christian contemplative voice as a voice of a polyphony of the universal spirit's openness to transcendence. And it's in that context that he was invited to attend a conference in Bangkok, Thailand, of monastics from around the world. And he got permission to go to have firsthand exposure to the Buddhists and to dialogue with them. And while there, he met with the Dalai Lama. He wrote a journal on this, the Asian Journal. And he gave a conference that conference was recorded. You can see the video of that conference. And he was to have a question and answer period that night. And he didn't come down for the question and answer period. He went in his room and found him dead on the floor. The fan was on his chest, and he was short in the fan. And he died of electrocution there. 53 years old, December the 10th, 1968. And so that's Thomas Merton. And I found out about Thomas Merton when I was in the ninth grade. My father was a violent alcoholic, and there's a lot of chaos at home. And in a ninth grade religion class, someone mentioned Thomas Merton and monasteries. And I went that day after school, and they had one book by Thomas Merton in the library, The Sign of Jonas, which is a journal he kept as a monk in the monastery. And on the first page of that book, Thomas Merton says, he said, "As for me, I have but one desire, the desire for solitude, to disappear into the secret of God's face." And at 14 years old, I did not know what that meant, but something in me did. And I said, "Me too." I don't even know what it means, and caught me in. And I read that book. I got my own copy. I read it over and over and over and over again. And I was so drawn to it, I went there. And entered about 2 days after I graduated from high school. And was there for nearly 6 years. And Thomas Merton was novice master for the choir novices there. And so I came under his spiritual direction for 3 of the 6 years that I was there. And he had a very profound effect on me, obviously. And so that's Thomas Merton. And so we're trying here to get at his teachings, particularly his teachings on being awakened to and surrendering ourselves over to God, who is infinitely surrendered over to us, breath by breath, moment by moment, and how do we meet God in that reciprocity of love, day by day. Now, we can't do justice here to this, but if we can touch the essence of it, you know, if we can get a feeling for the tonal quality of the intimate richness of it, so if on your own you're so inclined, you can go there and read Merton, and he might be among your teachers, among the people who guide you and help you in this. So the teachings, a basic flavor of the teachings of Thomas Merton. You got the handout? Got the handout. I would say first, in trying to understand the mystics, all the mystics, that there's a vision aspect and a path aspect to mystical teachings. The vision aspect bears witness to what reality looks like through awakened eyes. I'll give an example of this. What if right now we could all close our eyes and be interiorly awakened, so that when we opened our eyes, we'd see through our own awakened eyes what Jesus saw and all that he saw? What would we see? We'd see God, because Jesus saw God in all that he saw. What's amazing about it, when we sit with the Gospels, is it didn't seem to matter whether Jesus saw the joy of those at a wedding or the sorrow of those gathered at the burial of a loved one. It didn't matter whether he saw a prostitute or his own mother. It didn't matter whether he saw a person of great wealth and power or a poor widow dropping the last coin in the box. It didn't matter whether he saw his own disciples or his executioners. It didn't matter whether he saw a flower or a bird. Jesus saw God in all that he saw. And then Jesus said, "You have eyes to see, but you do not see." You don't see the God-given, godly nature of everything that you see, yourself, other people, the passing of the day. And that this is the source of all your sorrow. This is the source of all your confusion. And so the prayer is the prayer of the blind man in the Gospels, "Lord, that I might see." See, "Lord, that I might see you in all that I see. Lord, that I might see you in the concrete immediacy that I see the palms of my own hands. See, that I might see the divinity of everything in its nothingness without you." And so what Merton is doing here then is he's bearing witness to the spiritual worldview of contemplative Christianity, this deep seeing of the divinity of the world, of ourselves, of everything, in its nothingness without God. And so today, you know, we have a political worldview, which is in the news these days. We have a scientific worldview. We have an economic worldview. We have a worldview based on specific religious dogmatic assertions of a particular traditions. But a spiritual worldview is hard to find. The culture we live in lets us down in a way. It gives us an impoverished understanding of the nature of our situation. You're in a situation, I'm in a situation. But what's the ultimate situation that utterly transcends and totally permeates the intimate details of every situation? That's the spiritual worldview. See, how can I understand the ultimate, really divine horizon of my situation that I'm in today? And so this passage here in Merton, and we'll see the same with Teresa. Merton understands his worldview in terms of the nature of the self, the ultimate identity of the self. And this is from New Seeds of Contemplation. So I will read sections of this quote. You see it there on the blue sheet. And you don't need to get it out, but it's there. Every one of us is shadowed by an illusory person of false self. Excuse the sexist language. It's before they knew better. This is the man I want myself to be, but who cannot exist because God does not know anything about him. And to be unknown of God is altogether too much privacy. My false and private self is the one who wants to exist outside the reach of God's will and God's love, outside of reality and outside of life. And such a self cannot help be but an illusion. We are not very good at recognizing illusions, least of all the ones we cherish about ourselves, the ones we are born with and which feed the roots of sin. For most people in the world, there is no greater subjective reality than this false self of theirs, which cannot exist. A life devoted to the cult of the shadow is what is called a life of sin. All sin starts from the assumption that my false self, the self that exists only in my own egocentric desires, is the fundamental reality of life to which everything else in the universe is ordered. Thus, I use up my life in the desire for pleasures and the thirst for experiences, for power, honor, knowledge, and love to clothe this false self and construct its nothingness into something objectively real. And I wind experiences around myself and cover myself with pleasures and glory like bandages, in order to make myself perceptible to myself and to the world as if I were an invisible body that only became visible when something visible covered its surface. But there is no substance under the things with which I am clothed. I am hollow. And my structure of pleasures and ambitions has no foundation. I am objectified in them, but they are all destined by the very contingency to be destroyed. And when they are gone, there will be nothing left of me but my own nakedness and emptiness and hollowness to tell me that I am my own mistake. The secret of my identity is hidden in the love and mercy of God. But whatever is in God is really identical with him, for his infinite simplicity admits no division and no distinction. Therefore, I cannot hope to find myself anywhere except in him. Ultimately, the only way I can be myself is to become identified with him in whom is hidden the reason and the fulfillment of my existence. Therefore, there is only one problem on which all my existence, my peace, and my happiness depend: to discover myself in discovering God. And if I find him, I will find myself. And if I find my true self, I will find him. I'd like to reflect on this. I want to speak of it poetically. That when God created you, God did not have to think up who you might be. God didn't, boy, this is a challenge right here. Come up with this one. I really think this over. Because for all eternity, God eternally knows who you eternally are. Because through all eternity, God eternally contemplates you in Christ. Our lives are hidden with Christ in God. This is the you God knows you to be before the origins of the universe. This is the you that never began. And the you that never began is the you that will never die. And since everything in God is God, this is the divinity of you. This is your God-given, godly identity as a person. Transubjective communion. And in the Trinitarian life of God, this is your identity. The person that you are. Then God, in creating you, endows this person that you are as a capacity for divinity. God endows the person that you are with a nature, a human nature. And the glory of human nature, the most noble thing about human nature is not reason, although reason is certainly noble and distinguishes us from animals and so forth. The most noble thing about human nature is the capacity in our nature to discover the person. And to discover the person is the intimate experience that the deepest depths of the depths of me is, by the infinite generosity of God, the deepest depths of the depths of God, given to me as my own deepest depths. See? That if we think of God as generosity, if we think of God as generosity, the generosity of the infinite is infinite, and you are the generosity of God. That your identity is, by God's generosity, the very identity of God, given to you as your own deepest identity. And there are moments where you realize this in life, that the precious, here's a poetic image of this. You know, if you ever hold a newborn infant, you know that mysterious weight of a newborn? Somebody so tiny like this. It's kind of neat. And you know how they have that reflex, whatever that is, they clasp your little finger? So imagine you got this little newborn infant, this little human being about this big, and you got your little finger out like this, and this newborn infant has your little finger like that. The thing about this infant is it is completely useless. Really, it doesn't contribute to anything. It doesn't help with the chores. It can't help you sort out your problems. It doesn't chip in and do its part. As a matter of fact, it's amazing how someone so little takes over the whole house. See? It doesn't help with anything. We might say that the infant is the epitome of limit. The infant is the essence of limit. It can't even roll over by itself. It can't even feed itself. It's absolutely the essence of limit. And yet, with the imperial strength with which it clasps your extended little finger, like a king or queen holding a scepter, it all but carries your heart away. See? You know that if you were to die in the act of saving the life of this infant, you would die in the truth. Knowing that to save the life of this infant, the willingness to die to save the life of the infant would die in the truth, is recognizing the person. See? It's the person. See, the Gabriel Marcel, we know we learn to love someone when we glimpsed in them that which is too beautiful to die. And we know we learn to love ourselves when we glimpse in us something that's just too beautiful to die. It's the eternality of the preciousness of the essence of ourself. And our human nature then is endowed with the capacity to reverberate with this recognition, like, oh my God, see, that I'm worth all that God is worth, that I'm worth all that God is worth. And recognizing it in my nature, I'm then endowed with the freedom to say yes to it, because love is never imposed, it's always offered. So recognizing the God-given, godly nature of my identity, I'm then endowed with the freedom to say yes to that. See? And so the mystery of freedom is the mystery of saying yes to who God eternally knows that we are before we were born. And the scary thing about freedom is that we say no instead of yes. And in saying no, here's the image I have of this. Imagine, to take from Eckhart, imagine you're looking at a full-length image of yourself in a mirror. And imagine the image of yourself can think. It's a reflective thinking image of you. And this image of you has been through a lot of therapy. It's taken intensive journal workshops, has several degrees, and it has decided the time has come to launch out on its own and that it doesn't need you. So it lets you know this. It says, I'm leaving. See, you can't hold me back. I'm heading out. You try to break it as gently as possible. The things would not go well for the image of you without you because it's an image of you. But the image says, no, I will not be held back. And so to prove your point, you step halfway off the edge of the mirror, half the image disappears, it has a panic attack, has to go back on Xanax, goes back into therapy, and says to the therapist, I'm not real, I'm not real, I'm not real. Now, the image of you is real. It just wasn't real in the way it was trying to be real. And that's the way it is with God. See? We try to set up shop on our own. And we go off. We wind experiences around ourselves like bandages, see, in order to become real to ourselves and to the world. Want to hear what I achieved? Want to hear what I've done? Want to hear what I've done? See? But there is no substance under the things with which I am clothed. I am hollow. And when they are gone, there will be nothing left of me, I love this line, but to tell me I am my own mistake. See, that's a great line. See. But there is something in me, in my nothingness, that shines bright, and it's God. See. My absolute, if God would stop loving you into your chair at the count of three, at the chair of three, your chair would be empty at the count of three. Because you are nothing, absolutely nothing, outside the love of God. But your absolute nothingness without God makes your very presence to be the presence of God here. The discovery of that is a spiritual awakening like that. And so it's in the light of this worldview. So then all of life can be understood in these terms. The spiritual path is the path in which our human nature, our reflective human nature, is liberated from the distortions and the confusions of its imagined separateness from the infinite. So by it sets us on a path of unitive consciousness and love and generosity and openness as liberation. And so I would put it this way with Merton, then. This is the vision. So now the thing is, well, how do I do that? Like I say, this sounds very lovely to me. But how do I go about liberating myself from the illusions of my separateness in order to live in an habitual state of the God-given, godly nature of me and my nothingness without God? Do you have any helpful hints? See? So this is now the practical guidelines of Thomas Merton as a teacher, because it has to come home to rest to our experience. Otherwise, it's just poetry. But how do I actually taste this for myself and live by it? Because that's what counts. Here's how it came to me when I was with Merton in spiritual direction. It occurred to me, I would see him once every other week for about an hour. And for this one-on-one spiritual direction. And it seemed to me, during all our times together, all the things that we said with each other could be understood under the auspices of three questions. Three questions that were always being asked, responded to. The first question. And this, he would literally start this way. He'd say, how's it going? That's how he'd start. How's it going? In other words, what he was really asking is, what's it like being you in this monastery? He said, why have we come to this monastery? He said, we've come here to live. And we've come here to live. What's it like for you waking up in the morning? What's it like for you chanting the psalms in the choir? What's it like for you eating dinner and walking in the woods and going to sleep at night? Talk to me. See, tell me what it's like to be you here. And so it's immediately incarnational. It's just real like that. Second question you would ask, how's it going in your surrender to the mystery that accessed your heart and has brought you to this place that it might translate you into itself? See? There was a moment where your heart was mysteriously accessed by love. And in being touched by love, claimed by love, like a moment of resting in God, resting in you, see, it withdrew itself. And it set within your heart a longing for a more daily abiding awareness for the depths so fleetingly glimpsed. See, in my most childlike hour, I have glimpsed that without which my life is forever incomplete. And I am on a path seeking to be habitually grounded in that which momentarily accessed me. And how's that going for you? See? How's it going for you? How's it going in your surrender to the mystery that accessed your heart and has brought you to this place that it might translate you into itself? Talk to me about it. And the third question was for Merton, how's it going in discovering the intimate mystery of the second question, welling up into the intimate details of the messy edges of the first question? See, am I a mystic yet? Am I a mystic yet? What do you think? Think I'll make it? I'll start levitating any day now, I can tell. You know what I used to do? I used to think when I was in the monastery, I was 18 years old. I was so sincere about all of this. And in effect, not literally, but I was asking God, look, if I could just live a half inch off the floor, that's all I'm asking. Just glide down. I had monk's robes on, my head was shaved, and my rosary, just glide. And every morning I'd wake up, I was still me. Trance. See? So how's it going in discovering the intimate mystery of the second question, welling up in the messy, intimate details of your fragmented heart? See, it isn't a matter of overcoming anything. It's realizing that infinite love is already hopelessly in love with you in the midst of all your unfinished business, like that. How endearing it is, really. Have you realized that yet? Which is the gift of tears, really. How can I realize this love? And this process for Merton takes place in two fundamental phases. The first phase is the phase of cultivating psychological spiritual maturity in the spiritual life. So I am to incarnate in my life the cultivation of attitudes through the purification of my heart of fear, anger, resentment, self-loathing, disengagement from the immediacy of what's happening, the whole sad litany, or I kind of stay a stranger to my deepest self, and it's a perpetual path of discipleship to be habitually grounded in my attitudes and in my faith in God's ever-abiding love for me in my ordinariness. So here's some passages from Thomas Merton on this phase of it. This is from a book called The Intimate Merton, which is a collection of journal entries of Merton. Some of his finest writings are the journal entries, this autobiographical sense of God's presence in life. This is a journal entry, October the 2nd, 1958, Feast of the Guardian Angels. Brilliant and gorgeous day, bright sun, breeze making all the leaves and high brown grasses shine, singing of the wind and the cedars, exultant day in which even a puddle in the pig lot shines like precious silver. Finally, I'm coming to the conclusion that my highest ambition is to be what I already am, that I will never fulfill my obligation to surpass myself unless I first accept myself. And if I accept myself fully in the right way, I will already have surpassed myself. For it is the unaccepted self that stands in my way and will continue to do so as long as it is not accepted. When it has been accepted, it is my own stepping stone to what is above me, because this is the way man has been made by God. Original sin was the effort to surpass oneself by becoming like God, that is, unlike oneself. But our God-likeness begins at home. We must first become like ourselves and stop living beside ourselves. That we are committed, there is the moral imperative. It's like recovery last night. We were talking about addiction and acceptance. We are committed to take responsibility for attitudes in our mind and heart that are unloving towards ourselves and other people. All things considered, what's the most loving thing I can do right now for my body, my mind, this person, this family, this community, this animal, this earth, all things considered. See? And when I commit myself to that, when I lean into it, I discover the ways that my heart is still divested in a compromised life, because I discover prejudices, I discover resentments, I discover blame, I discover holding on to past hurts, I discover a whole litany of my compromised heart. Then I set up the idolatry of perfectionism. That what I'm going to do, what I'm going to do is I'm going to break through and rise above all my faults. And having become the spiritually perfect person that I know I can be, by God, I can do this. I'll make it. But then you realize what you're really to do is to take responsibility for being as loving as you can and know that God is hopelessly in love with you and your inability to get past what you can't get past. Because that's the gift of tears. That's experiential salvation. There's nothing to overcome, actually. There's nothing to overcome. And God takes us to herself just as we are, as precious in our fragility. And this is self-acceptance. You know, I'm 72 years old. Senility and enlightenment are in a race to the finish line. And imagine you're on your deathbed and you call for your spiritual director. You had this director for years, and your director comes in, leans over your bed, and says, "You know what? I expected better than this, really. Really? B plus on a curve? I don't know. I don't know." And you say in a weak voice, "I'm trying." So I know, I call it the way I see it. And that's when you know you should have chosen a better, different director. It's a little late. But we all have somebody like that inside. There's the punitive voice, and it is unrelenting. It is unrelenting. It's punitive towards the part of us that needs to be loved the most. The part of us that can't get past the hurting thing. We don't know how. And so self-acceptance, experiential salvation by being taken into God's tender love, just the way we are. This is what a family should be. A family should be a gathering of people that offer each other this. Of course, the mystery is you bring into the relationship the unfinished brokenness of your heart and you act it out on each other. Next quote from Merton, at this level, one of the most well-known quotes by Merton, this is in Thoughts and Solitude. "My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I'm following your will does not mean I'm actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, will I trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone. See? Isn't this true about life, really? That you can look back to things in your life where you were caught up in things that never should have happened. Really. Sometimes there are things that were done to you. Maybe you were too little to cooperate. Maybe you were older and they were done to you. Maybe you cooperated to your own detriment and to the detriment of other people. But is it also not true that God writes straight with crooked lines, and you would not be who you are today had you not been found by God in an unlikely hour in the midst of your difficulties? Is that not true? Someone once said Thomas Merton was a gentle man, and he was gentle because God was so gentle with him. This is what addiction's all about. This is what brokenness is all about. This is what deep healing and therapy is all about. When you lay bare the hurting place, you're in the grips of something that will not let go of you, that has you ritualistically reenacting sad and hurtful things upon yourself and other people. And in the very vulnerable act of laying it bare, you're met by God taking you tenderly, see, to himself as precious in the very midst of your fragility. This is the mystery of love crucified. You will never leave me to face my perils alone. Never. And so this is Thomas Merton. A lot of passages in Merton breathe through this incarnate kind of honesty, this incarnate kind of reality, this incarnate kind of, let's be real with each other. And, we're all in this together. We're all in this together. Here's another way to look at this. Look back at your life. Ask this question. How has it come to pass? Look back over your shoulder at your life until now. How has it come to pass that you have come to be who you, right up to this very moment, have come to be as a man or woman sitting here now, able to hear and understand these things at the level at which you're able to hear and understand them today? How has it come to pass? Look at your circuitous life up till now. You could not have planned it if you tried. Thank you. You could not have planned it if you tried. See? And so we're on a journey not of our own making. And we lean into it with patient, obediential fidelity. God is a presence that protects us from nothing, even as God unexplainably sustains us in all things. And we learn to trust in this sustaining guidance day by day by day by day. And to help each other do the same, because we're all in the same boat, really, like this. So I think this is Merton. I think this is the feel of a lot of Merton. It's a lot of Merton. The next step now is, where does this start to become mystical? See, let's say you're living this way. More or less, you're living in the messy edges of your own story. At what point does the messy edges of your own story, is it already beginning to reverberate with mystical oneness with God in the midst of the fragility of your heart? And as Merton says, maybe it has been for a long time, but you've not recognized it. He said there are many people who are being called to a more interior, mystical union with God, and they don't know it because they have no one to bear witness to them, to the nature of the holiness of the situation that they're in, like this. So this is where I'd like to move now, and for the talk afterwards to this morning, I want to stay with this mystical dimension. And now we're kind of moving into where all of us already are. We were anxious to get into it. because it's when you offer a day like this, when you advertise a day like this, it tends to draw a certain bird out of the underbrush. And who's it draw? It draws people who are already in this. Because if you weren't already into it, it wouldn't have occurred to you to sign up for something like this. You know, no thanks, I'll pass. No thanks. I got chores to do. Oh, this looks good. You know why it looks good? You're already into it. See? And so how does Merton shed a light on this very subtle, delicate, mystical dimensions of what's happening to us in our hearts? And this is a New Seeds of Contemplation, the blue the handout again. Oh dear, okay, all right. If I want to keep up with my lesson plan, I have to be careful to not start talking real fast, huh? Wouldn't that be a mistake? Last two paragraphs of New Seeds of Contemplation. I'll read this and give a reflection, then we'll stand and stretch. Take a break. It starts out, what is serious to men? Do you see that at the top there of the page? What is serious to men? What is serious to men is often very trivial in the sight of God. What in God might appear to us as play is perhaps what God takes most seriously. At any rate, the Lord plays and diverts himself in the garden of his creation. And if we could let go of our own obsession with what we think is the meaning of it all, we might be able to hear his call and follow him in his mysterious cosmic dance. We do not have to go very far to catch echoes of that game and of that dancing. When we are alone on a starlit night, when by chance we see the migrating birds in autumn descending on a grove of junipers to rest and eat, when we see children in a moment they are really children, when we know love in our own hearts, or when, like the Japanese poet Basho, we hear an old frog land in a quiet pond with a solitary splash. At such times, the awakening, the turning inside out of all values, the newness, the emptiness, and the purity of vision that make themselves evident provide a glimpse of the cosmic dance. For the world and time are the dance of the Lord in emptiness. The silence of the spheres is the music of a wedding feast. The more we persist in misunderstanding the phenomena of life, the more we analyze them out into strange finalities and complex purposes of our own, the more we involve ourselves in sadness, absurdity, and despair. But it does not matter very much, because no despair of ours can alter the reality of things or stain the joy of the cosmic dance, which is always there. Indeed, we are in the midst of it, and it is in the midst of us, for it beats in our very blood, whether we want it to or not. Yet the fact remains that we are invited to forget ourselves on purpose, cast our awful solemnity to the winds, and join in the general dance. I like to reflect on this. That's not bad. Wouldn't you say that's pretty good? Oh, geez. Merton first bears witness to the already perfectly holy nature of the world as God's body. He bears the world and time are the dance of the Lord in emptiness. The silence of the spheres is the music of a wedding feast. See, he starts there. Next, there are moments we are intimately awakened to this dance. And notice the examples that he uses are very subtle moments. Really, turning to see a flock of birds descending, and as if out of the corner of your eye, you catch in their descent something that has no name, something holy. See, knowing love in your own heart, knowing love in your own heart. Seeing children in a moment, they are really children. My wife and I, we were visiting my grandchildren some years ago, and they were going to eat Kraft macaroni and cheese or something and go to bed. And then we were going to stay up, my daughter and her husband and my wife and I, we were going to play cards or something, I don't know. And we were going to order pizza. But they knew we were going to get pizza. That's the key to the story. And so my daughter said, you know, it's time to go to bed. And she said, please, please, please let me stay up. She said, I never got to see an old person eat pizza before. Yeah. Now, what do you do with that? Seriously. Honest to God. You know what I mean? It's disarming is what it is. It's completely disarming. To see children in a moment, they're really children. They break your heart wide open. Something amazing there, absolutely amazing, really. And so these utterly simple moments like that, that you're intimately accessed by something. If you weren't careful, you would have missed it, but you didn't miss it. You didn't miss it. And I'd like to meditate on one of these moments. See? So they occur in the midst of nature. We're talking about grace last night in these terms. It comes to us in the midst of nature, lying awake at night, listening to the rain, whatever. It comes in the arms of the beloved. It comes in being with a child. It comes in the pause between two lines of a poem. It comes to us in stopping to help somebody. And they thought no one even noticed. When you stop and say, are you okay? That look of gratitude in their eyes. There's no words for that. Really. Who's helping whom at that moment? Really. Or a moment you felt lost, and you didn't think anyone noticed, and someone asked if you were okay, and save your life. Really. It comes in birth, it comes in death, it comes in suffering, it comes in great joy, it comes as it comes. But there is a moment where for a fleeting instant, you realize what a fool I am to worry so. Fear has no foundations. There is no place for sorrow. See? In a way that I cannot grasp, everything is more than okay, actually. And it's clarity, like this. So here's the image. Here's the image down there. Here's the image. We'll end with this image. Let's say you're driving home from work at night and there's a sunset. And you pull over to the side of the road, you turn off the car, and it's just one of these stunning sunsets, and you give yourself over to the beauty of the setting sun giving itself over to you. It's one of those moments. See? You're kind of taken by it, really. And you see the time has passed, it's getting dark, and you go home, pick up some groceries, pull in the driveway, take out the garbage, get the mail. You're standing in the kitchen throwing out the advertisements, hoping the dreaded bill isn't there, that you don't want to arrive. And standing in your own kitchen, you remember the moment out with the setting sun, and you ask yourself, here's the question. Why do I spend so many of my waking hours trapped on the outer circumference of the inner richness of the life that I'm living? See, why? Like this. This is my own home, but in some deep way, I don't live here. Imagine you found out you've inherited a large, elaborately furnished mansion. You're just amazed and delighted, and you go there. The only downside is you don't have the keys. So you have to live in a little tent near the garage of your elaborately furnished mansion. And one of the weekends, you invite all your relatives over to show off your mansion. And after the little cookout in the backyard, you casually say, would you like to see the place? And they're looking through the leaded glass windows, and with pride in your voice, you say, here's the music room, the grand parlor, the library. I'll get a ladder, show you the bedrooms. And they say, you know, it's an amazing place you have here. You go, well, I like it. But I can't get in there. Now, what if really you were born in the mansion, you've been living in it and are in it now, but through a tragic mental condition, you think you're in a little tent out by the garage, and every week you go to therapy, see? And your therapist says, listen to me, I wouldn't mislead you on this one, really. Honest to God, honest, really, listen to me. You're in the, no, I don't even deserve to think I could even figure out a way to get in there anyway. I don't even know why I even think like that. In God, we live and move and have our being. Nothing is missing here, really. But you'd never guess it by how we go about wringing our hands, fretting so. See, like this. It's enough to make God sit on a stone somewhere and weep. Really. See, and here's the strange thing. In my most childlike hour, my heart has not deceived me. There was the quickening, the great awakening, and I intuit that in that moment, in the arms of the beloved with the child in a moment of solitude, I wasn't given something more than all of this. A curtain opened, and I fleetingly tasted the fullness of what every moment is. It's right now at this moment, but I'm trapped on the outer circumference of the inner richness of the infinite love of God pouring herself out and giving herself away. It's this moment. And I can't, it's like that. And what am I to do? What am I to do? That ache in our heart, that intimate ache of a state of exile or a kind of a homesickness within one's heart is the impetus for the path to be healed from the confusion. And this is where the guidance of Thomas Merton becomes mystical. For us, let's stand and stretch.